Hello there and welcome to Off The Canvas podcast with me, Nick Hobbs. Now, to coincide with World Mental Health Day, we're going to be speaking to some well-known names within boxing to candidly discuss their personal experiences with mental health. Today, our guest is journalist Tris Dixon, who has decades of experience in boxing at all levels. Now, we did suffer some audio issues while recording this podcast. I'd like to stress that none of that was Tris's fault, who was absolutely fantastic to work with on this. The blame lies solely with me, but I have tried to tinker with it as best as I can to bring it up to the highest possible standards for you, because Tris has some really interesting things to say. So I apologise for that, but I hope you enjoy the podcast anyway. Let's start off with an easy one. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, I'm doing okay. About to pack off the gear for the WBC convention, so looking forward to that.
Tris, what is it about boxing that drew you in and continues to draw you in?
It's a strange one, really. I always watched it as a kid. I was sort of watching the Benz, the Eubanks, the Watsons, the Harold Grahams, and of course the Tysons. And I was watching them as a kid without really thinking, just as a casual fan, I suppose. And then, some of those fights, I can remember where I was when I was sort of 10, 11, 12 and stuff. I do remember. I was playing rugby at an okay level. A couple of the guys who I was playing rugby with said, for fitness, we're going down to the boxing club. So why don't you come down to just help your fitness out? And then I started boxing. This was at the age of 16. So I strode down to the boxing club on a Tuesday and Thursday in Salisbury in Wiltshire. And I really enjoyed it. Then it came to the point where I was maybe picking up a dead leg in rugby or something, and then I could train how I wanted to do boxing. But ultimately, I just had to make a choice between not being that good at rugby and not being that good at boxing. And I chose boxing.
There's something about boxing gyms as well, isn't there? I mean, every single one of them has got an array of characters that, for a lot of people, you just wouldn't come across every now and then. Everyone just gets chucked in together, and you see how you get on, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. The thing is, once you're in there and you're sweating alongside people and bleeding alongside people, there is a camaraderie that's forged, and there is a bond, and you do all get close, and you will have a mutual respect, which you don't necessarily have in other sports, because you don't go to the streets that you go to in boxing with sparring. And I think that the amount of work that you do together with someone, whether it's sparring or even if you're just alongside a teammate, you have a lot of respect for them, and that carries over inside and outside the ring.
From that level, just the initial walking into a boxing gym to the highest of ranks of the sport, how do you consider mental health to currently be viewed?
I think there's a little bit more understanding and certainly more tolerance for it than there used to be. It's one of those things that it's become, I don't want to say a buzzword as if it's become trendy, but certainly there's so much more about it now than there used to be. And I think people are starting to understand and talk about it more. I mean, it's taken a lot. It's taken a lot of high-profile catastrophe. It's taken a lot of suicide. It's taken a lot of people struggling to get to this point, which is a real shame, obviously, because even one tragedy is one too many. But it has taken a long time. But it's something now that I think, when you look at the big names of your Frank Bruno, your Joe Calzaghe, your Ricky Hatton, guys who suffered in the Mike Tyson as well. Mm-hmm. When you look at those big names, it's easy to forget that it's a big problem all the way through the sport, all the way down at every level, and not just the fighters, but the trainers, the managers, the promoters. It's just a very stressful sport one way or another.
If you were suffering in some way, there's certain coping mechanisms and advice people would get in terms of don't isolate yourself, eat proper food, don't be knackered, don't get punched in the head. Boxing throws this all at you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and when I talk about the camaraderie and that, it does have a lot of family sort of elements to it, which is great. But still, people and certainly the guys that I've known being around for a long time, it's been a bit of a taboo subject for people to talk about. If you're feeling a bit low, we're in a this is a man's sport. Mm-hmm. So what? You put gloves on and you fight. your rope out, you skip, you move, you do something, you don't stop and feel sorry for yourself for a long period of time. Kickboxing's always had a relatively sort of dark ages mentality when it comes to traditions in terms of training, in terms of nutrition, and now in terms of mental health. It has generally been, I think, behind the curve somewhat.
Yeah.
And I think that's been an issue. Now, I think with what you're trying to do and the different things that are out there, people are addressing it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's a long, long way to go. But, you know, if there was an amateur fight that my kid was feeling down, or if there was a pro who just turned pro, or an A-lister who struggled with depression, would they know where to go? Probably not.
Yeah. How long have you been reporting on the sport? Sorry, Tris.
So my first report was written in 1996, so 22 years.
In those 22 years, have you found when interviewing fighters, they open up more now or more then, or has there not been too much of a change in that?
I think more now. I mean, the first one that ever said anything to me was in about 2007, 2008,
and
Darren Sutherland.
Oh, right.
And Darren was training in London under Brian Knott. And I remember I was doing an interview with him for our sister magazine, the Fox News, called Fighting Fit. And I said to Darren, like, you know, he's such a hyped prospect. And he was, you know, flying, I think it was, you know, 3 or 4 and I was a pro. Had this fantastic reputation, you know, was a couldn't fit prospect.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, like, wow, you know, things are really fun. They're going really well for you, aren't they? And he's like, well, I can't quote exactly, because it's a while ago now, but he said basically, I'm just really depressed. I'm just really down about everything.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't have the level of education really that I have now. Not that it's a formal education about depression, but I didn't understand then what I know now.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, just loopy, like, the guy's got the world at his feet. What could be wrong with it?
Do you think?
I think I wrote about that in the speech, saying it's a bit unique that he would say that, but you know, it was just one of those things. And obviously, Darren committed suicide, and it was just a terrible tragedy for boxing and all concerned.
What, if any, lessons can be learned, do you think, from the sport, from what happened to Darren?
It's so hard, isn't it? I think that Darren was one of the guys, because he was such a prospect, though. I think he was one of the guys who has helped more people, you know, admit to it and take ownership of it. And I think it was so sad, obviously, to lose Darren, who was a lovely man. But I do think he was one of the guys that made a significant difference for people in terms of coming forward and admitting stuff like that. I think that was, so like I said, I think that was in about 2008, and I wrote on my, for the first time I actually wrote about depression in boxing was, I believe, 2010, 2011.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was, I was writing Ricky Hatfield's biography, War of Peace, with him, and I was doing that, and I was, Joe Calzaghe had been in the headlines, obviously, Bruno had insight. There were some really high-profile guys, and I was thinking, and then I was going through my divorce at the time. I was just thinking, why is it that everyone in boxing seems to suffer in one way, shape, or form?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that came out that Steve Powell committed suicide as well. And I was writing that piece, and I remember putting something on Twitter saying, write a piece about depression. If any boxers want to talk about it, you know, just DM me. And then I ended up getting, I don't know, maybe 2 dozen DMs from boxers in this country and in America, just saying, yeah, it's me, I'm doing it, you know, I'm feeling alone, I'm on my own. And you know, some of them were high profile names, and some of them weren't, but this goes back to what I was saying earlier, it happens at all levels. And I think when you look at all levels, I mean, sometimes I try and identify with it. Obviously I can't identify with the top level, but I know when I was an amateur, the pressure of a fight was really all-consuming, and not just the nerves before a fight, but for me, especially after I lost a couple, it was about, I didn't want to let anyone down, so at the start, I wanted everyone to know I was a fighter, so I was saying, yeah, I'm a boxer, you know, I've got tickets, I'm fighting here, come and, you know, come and see me and stuff. After you lose a couple, people start saying, oh, when's your next fight, and, oh, how do we get tickets, where can I go, is it a bus, and all that stuff. the pressure just gets so much, and then it becomes your whole identity. Everyone who stops you in the streets, everyone knows all the fighters in their sort of community. Everyone will stop you and say, oh, how's your training going? How's your fight? It becomes your whole identity. It's what you are. And everything becomes about the next fight. And it's an incredibly lonely situation. You're the one who's ultimately going to go and put your head on the block.
Yeah.
And after that fight, then you've obviously got an exhilaration which you can't match the normal life, or you have a real low when you sort of let everyone down. For me personally, it got to the point where I didn't want to let anyone down, so I stopped telling people when I was fighting. And I would go to fights with just a friend, and I'd meet my coach there, and I'd go there, I'd fight, and I'd leave, and that was it. And I didn't tell anybody until after the event. And even if I'd lost, I didn't tell anyone. if I won, I told everybody.
It is quite poignant, Tris, that we're talking on the two-year anniversary of Mike Towell's death. And it's sort of a reminder as well that not only is there this pressure to perform and to win and to be seen to win, but also there's got to be this part of a boxer's mind that's thinking how much they're risking and what the consequences could possibly be.
Yeah, I mean, I write a book on the long-term effects of brain injuries in boxing now. And so that's looking more at punch drunk syndrome than CTE. And that, you know, but I'm sure a lot of fighters don't think of what's going to happen to them down the line. I think these fighters who sign up and understand the risk think about the short term stuff. And I think they think about, you know, getting a cut eye or a broken nose or being knocked out or even, you know, maybe worst case scenario, carried from the ring. I don't think too many of them appreciate the fact that you can retire and be in great health. And then 10 or 15 years later, your health is fine. And, you know, with CTE and punch drunk syndrome, it was first coined in 1928 in a medical paper, it's tough because that stuff can really affect your behavior. And that can also lead to depression, and it could cause depression. And then you're in a vicious cycle because it's not just that you're feeling down and alone, but there's actually something wrong with your brain and you're depressed. And there's been a lot of studies done into this, with American football and what have you, in the last 10 years. So again, there's a different level of understanding. So it's one thing being depressed and being an active fighter who might be healthy. It's another thing being depressed and 10 or 15 years down the line, your health starts to go. And there's not, you know, if it's something that's affected by your brain, then, you know, all the counselling in the world isn't going to help. So
yeah. A reoccurring theme of this podcast series has been fighters talking about what life's like after boxing and the struggles they have of adapting to calling themselves a former fighter. And a couple of people we've spoken to have said that there's just nothing in place for a boxer once they retire. But when we were talking, we were struggling to work out what should be in place and whose responsibility that should be. What are your thoughts on that, Tris?
Oh my God, that's a huge topic. It's a huge topic, and there's so many different strands to it. I think it's so difficult because, you know, all fighters want to be world champions or British champions, or you know, they want to strive to that, and that generally means that you need to sacrifice, and that means you need to sacrifice having a 9-to-5 or having a career because your career is as a boxer, and so when you retire, say at the age of 30 or 35. Everyone else in the real world has got 20-year head start on you. And, you know, you might have to go back to college or university. You might be damaged from your career, you know, which is such a hard sport, some way, shape, or form. And you're fighting a losing battle. So whose job is it? I mean, that's just massive. I mean, if there's no umbrella organisation in boxing, as you know. So, you know, the British Boxing Board of Control, I understand, working with Neil McKenzie and Lapp now to try and help people after boxing. But there's so much assistance needed because some of the guys don't, you know, having everything to having nothing, but then a lot also don't start this second part of their life with any kind of backing at all, no financial backing and no safety net. So once they stop fighting, the income stops from that, then there's no safety net. There's no way that they can take a back step. And it is really difficult. Like when you look at whose responsibility it is, because ultimately it is going to be the fighters. But, you know, what do they do? Do they then retrain in another profession? Do they go to college? Do they, you know, do they start over? What happens in the interim while all that's going on? You know, because some of them have families that they've not survived by then, so they can't just afford to go back to school or university and get qualifications for something where, like I said, they started at least a decade or two steps behind everyone else who's already out there working in employment.
Yeah.
So it's so tough. You know, without an umbrella organisation, which I do think often really needs, there's no one's responsibility but Pfizer, and that's sad because enough of them are aware of what lies ahead. I spoke to a really good friend of Pfizer the other day, he was in his early 30s, and I was like, well, what's the plan on boxing? And he said, well, you know, if I get my one on boxing, then it doesn't matter. And I'm like, well, no, but okay. You know, realistically, the guy's got maybe 2 or 3 years left, but what if he doesn't get what he wants out of box? You know, what then? You know, he's going to be 34, 35, and he's going to have, you know, the rest of his life ahead of him. He's got no plan.
Yeah. Tris, no.
And I hate to say it, but, you know, there's only one person to blame when you get to that age if you've got no backup plan.
Yeah. Tris, seeing what you've seen in the sport and knowing what you know, has it changed the way you view boxing as a fan?
Yeah, I mean, it has. It has, for sure. You know, that's why I'm thrilled to write the book that I'm focusing on at the moment. You know, when I see fighters have one savage fight after another, you know, I do think about what they'll be like later on in their life, you know, for sure. And, you know, I've been to the Hall of Fame in New York countless times, and you know, you see these rags of once great legends walking around and tossing around and sticks, and you know, it's just dreadful to see. So yeah, that does make me, it's not very questionable what I'm doing, but it just makes me hungry to get the education out there so people understand about the risk and what can be done to try and make it safer and a much better environment for everyone.
Tris Dixon, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Thank you for coming on Off the Canvas podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
I did warn you about the audio problems there. Hope it was worth it to hear Tris's thoughts there. Really interesting stuff from him. Now, if you are feeling down or you've hit a wall for any reason and need to talk or find information and support, then please visit www.thecalmzone.net or you can call 0800 58 58 58. Calls from the UK are free from landlines, payphones, and all mobiles. Thanks again for listening to the Off the Canvas podcast.